You are listening to How Do We Make It Better, the podcast where we explore how people in nonprofits, corporations, social enterprises, politics, and other walks of life try to make it better. Get this where all quality podcasts are found. Links to all those places are at bit.ly/How Do We Make It Better Podcast, or if that's too long, bit.ly/HDWMIB. You can also check us out at dougabdiel.com. That's dougabdiel.com. Today I interviewed Tim Strabing. He's been a lot of things: a Marine infantry officer, a government appointee, a head of a large philanthropy, and now a man who's focusing on his family and on his local community. He doesn't have a lot to ask of any of us, but I think asks all of us who have at one time or another pushed very hard on one vision of how the world should be reformed to consider whether or not we could start looking locally, either at those who are close enough to be often contemptuous for us, or those who are perhaps far enough away that they're overlooked, and consider whether perhaps building a community based on love and care and selfless service might be something that we could all consider doing more of in our near abroad. I hope that you enjoy this conversation with Tim Strabing. Tim, I have been chasing you for, I think it's nigh into a year and a half now, to try and sit down and talk to me, because somewhat like Rudy Rickner, I quite honestly feel like just about everything that I have done, you have like amped up one level more than me. You know, like, oh, well, Doug spent a little bit of time in philanthropy. Tim was, you know, setting up an entire program for West Point, worked as a philanthropy director for years and years, had a big staff working for him. I was following your footsteps a few years later as a Marine infantry officer. I generally feel like I'm just a few steps behind you all the time. So I really enjoy sitting down whenever we have a chance to talk. And I'm glad that for once, others might benefit from your perspective and thoughts about where you're heading finally. So thanks for joining me.
No, that's a very kind introduction. I think that I could also say, similar to you, that I've really enjoyed watching you flourish through your time in the Marine Corps and Columbia Business School. And that was neat when our lives intersected a little more closely in New York City. So yeah, we'll make the best of what we can here on the audio lines across continents.
Indeed. Well, we've already started kind of diving a little bit into our bios and where they intersect and stuff, but could you maybe just for the benefit of everybody, give us a little bit of the wave tops for you about who you are and why you're on about what you're on about today?
Sure. So I guess I can go back to childhood briefly. Grew up, because it will come back full circle. I grew up in a little farming community in Western Michigan, in the Midwest, a Dutch Reformed community where church and family and school were kind of a very tight radius in my life growing up. And then when I was 18, I decided not to go to the college that every single Strabing grandchild had gone to prior to me, and where my parents met, Calvin College in Grand Rapids, Michigan, but decided to go to the Naval Academy. So I always like to say I'm the black sheep of the Strabing family for going to the Naval Academy, and spent 4 years there. And when I left for the Naval Academy, my mother said to me, as long as you don't go into the Marine Corps, this will be okay. And so as things go,
oh, mom.
Yeah, exactly. It's really not until you have kids do you really appreciate a little bit of that sentiment. But yeah, so went into the Marine Corps as a ground designated officer before I went to the basic school, and had a strange kind of segue because I graduated in 2001 and was picked up for a scholarship, a Marshall scholarship, to study in England for 2 years, which at the time in May of 2001 sounded like a splendid idea. And then September 11 happened, and all my classmates are getting ready to deploy, defend the nation after this catastrophic event. And I'm stuck guarding the Bodleian Library at Oxford for 2 years and sort of chafing away. But as time goes, and
it's funny for those who don't have that experience in the military, it seems a little bit odd, but I completely understand what you're saying. Like it's as though you spend all of your time training for a game, but then you never get to play it. The idea that you know, you would actually want to go to war as a second lieutenant, as opposed to wanting to stay is a bit counterintuitive, but I completely understand the direction you're coming from.
Yeah. I think part of it's cultural, right? So if you come out of a culture with a high emphasis on service, and in this case, service to the nation, and you have, you know, kind of once in a century, or I guess we count from Pearl Harbor, 60 years forward type of thing happen, that traumatic event has a huge influence on the military community and the desire to want to do something and respond. I mean, we can circle back on the policy piece of that, but on a personal level, it's a fairly, I think, natural when you're within that military culture to want to kind of stand up and defend that which you know, you care about and desire to serve. So after I finished in Oxford, we invaded Iraq, and things were just starting to kind of get complicated as I was going through my schooling in Quantico. Did the 6 months of the base school, picked up infantry, and basically got to an infantry unit that was going to deploy as quickly as possible to Iraq. Did a 7 month deployment as a platoon commander just outside of Fallujah, and then did the push into Fallujah in November 2004 with a platoon. Thankfully, all my Marines came out of that deployment alive, not by God's grace, not necessarily my leadership, and some went back early with injuries and that type of thing, but it was a pretty intense deployment. Came back, got married, and then deployed again 6 months later, and did another 7 month deployment, this time further west, near Haditha Dam and these little towns in the Anbar province. Hakla Nia was the one where we spent the majority of the time. Came back from that deployment and then spent 3 years at the Naval Academy teaching in the political science department, which was a fantastic experience. And then we can come back to inflection points later, I guess, but made a difficult decision to leave active duty from the Marine Corps and basically traded in uniforms for suits, and took a job at the Department of Defense working special operations and counterinsurgency policy for about 3 years, in particular looking at security force assistance, how the United States goes about organized training, equipping foreign militaries that we're partnered with, like the Iraqi military or the Afghan military. Did that for about 3 years and then made the transition to the nonprofit sector, philanthropic work. And I did that for 6 years and worked with a family foundation in New York City, continuing some of the national security related things I did, and then focusing more squarely on education, in particular digital education, and a lot of partnerships we had with West Point, which were pretty interesting. And then just this last August, my family moved from New York City after 8 years to Detroit, Michigan. My wife, Jada, and I were feeling kind of restless in terms of feeling we felt like God was saying that we needed to start something new and make some changes. And so she got a great opportunity here in Detroit, and we decided to go for it and took our three kids along, and we're figuring it out as we go. So probably longer than you wanted, Doug, but I will pause there and let you kind of hop in and start deconstructing this a little bit.
Well, look, I guess what I struggle with, Tim, more than anything, is to kind of classify you. And maybe it's just because you're a man who defies classification. Like, I guess I would wonder if, and maybe this has changed, maybe because we're all self-rationalizing individuals, you would post hoc create a unifying thread here. But is there one thing that you feel like you have been trying to do, and that these are all different instantiations of this? Or have you perhaps, what was your mission, I guess, in each of those segments of your life? Or was it active duty, non-active duty, philanthropy, and now I think moving back to the Midwest and perhaps some retraining and some other things that you're doing there. Did you have a unifying mission, or did you feel like that mission itself inflected?
I think it evolves and changes. But if I would kind of like look back and try to like, you know, regress the mean or something, I guess what I would say is that there's a thread of kind of service before self, or selfless service, that I think has motivated it. And I think where it's evolved is that for a good chunk of time, that was focused primarily on serving the country around national security related issues. And where the evolution has taken place is that, you know, over the last few years, and especially with the move to Detroit, maybe the theme is still there, but it's no longer, I'm not as focused on national security, although I still think about it and read about it and those kind of things. I'm not in the sort of practitioner realm the way that I had been.
Okay. So let me press on that a little bit. So why? Sometimes we change what we're doing because we no longer believe that the way in which we are doing it is useful because of who we are. And sometimes we change what we're doing because the environment changes around us and we no longer believe that we're going to be able to make a difference in that spot in given the environmental change. My observation was, knowing you for much of this time, that the environment hadn't changed a lot. Certainly in Iraq or Afghanistan, the environment hadn't changed a great deal in DoD policy. The environment hadn't changed a lot in the world of philanthropy. So that leads me to believe that it's probably something about your personal take, and maybe you can reject this if it's incorrect, about the appropriate way to serve that changed. And I guess I would love if we could back up to kind of those pivot points between trading in a uniform for a suit and a suit for a desk at a nonprofit. Like, why did you, what was the logic behind those?
Maybe I'll work backwards on that. Let me give a little bit more in terms of sort of where I am today here in Detroit in the decision-making around that. So Doug, I think your analysis is right on in the sense that it's much been a personal evolution in some ways in the way that I view myself and view what my priorities should be. So, I mean, the most recent decision-making to kind of leave kind of full-time philanthropy and really re-architect my professional and personal life came down to what I was feeling like was a gap between what I said was my values or priorities and how my life was being lived. So we always say, family is the most important thing. My marriage is the most important thing. Kids are the most important thing. And then career comes after that. And the other piece for me is faith is really important to me. And I've always been active in churches and Christian communities that wherever I've lived and that kind of thing. But over time, I've discerned sort of this tug, this attraction, this call towards becoming better equipped to be able to work within faith communities. And so the decision to leave full-time philanthropic work that I'd sort of been in that arena for a half decade plus was really one of saying, okay, I have young kids. This is a really unique opportunity for me to invest much more deeply in my relationships with them and be able to pursue going to seminary and staying engaged on some consulting projects that are still interesting and challenging and those kind of things. And so that's been over the last 6 months, kind of departing New York and landing here in Detroit and getting established. It's, you know, and this gets a little bit away from kind of solving a big problem that can scale down to saying, wait, I really need to focus in on my relationships with my three kids and take advantage. I'm grateful for this. My wife's a professor and we have the financial ability where I can step off the treadmill a little bit with full-time work and spend a lot more time with our kids. We had a caregiver for 6 years while we were in New York City that made our lives work as sort of dual career professionals. And now we're entering in a phase where we're balancing it between the two of us. And that's possible because of the decisions that I've made sort of professionally for this near-term season. But I even draw that theme back out. Like, I feel like this is service just in another manifestation. Like, I needed to really live out what my values were when it came to being a father and a husband in a way that, not that I've got all these regrets about this sort of treadmill we were on in New York City, but it becomes incredibly hard to sustain that in the long term. Yeah. And that was Leander just slamming the door to the office. So that was fitting.
well timed, young man. Well, okay. So look, I guess maybe then a more fruitful way to attack this. I mean, I guess it's great in one regard that you came to this, before before marriage breakup. And I'm not saying that you were anywhere near to that when you guys moved to New York, but certainly some folks who I've had on before have gone hard their whole lives at something, at trying to achieve something. And the collateral damage for that was children who were estranged, second or third marriage, focus on career to the absence of all other things, right? If you were to do it again, and I think you were a government appointee in the DOD, which is non-trivially easy to come by. I know the pain from the Naval Academy prep program for the Trumans and Marshalls and Rhodes and that kind of stuff. Like, you would have been going hard at it at the at the Naval Academy. I know the pain of the infantry officer. Like, you have not done things by halves in any of those instances. Would you, I guess, commend to yourself in retrospect to do anything differently? Or do you actually feel like the level of investment that you invested in those other components of your life was appropriate at the time?
Wow, that's a great question. And I don't know if I've actually sort of applied that retroactively to decisions I've made. I think, absolutely, given what I know now at 39, I would have counseled 18-year-old or 22-year-old or 30-year-old Tim some around decisions that I made. I think, you know, one in particular that strikes me is the decision to leave active duty in the Marine Corps. I wish I would have explored further afield and potentially, not that I regret my time serving as the Department of Defense, but in hindsight, that was a very safe, comfortable decision to make that worked well for my own internal narrative and looked nice on LinkedIn and all that kind of thing. But I don't think was maybe the healthiest or best decision I should have made at the time. I mean, because part of it, one of the reasons I left active duty in the Marine Corps is that I was having an increasingly hard time reconciling my faith as a Christian with my professional responsibility to close with and destroy the enemy and to take life as required on battlefields. And it's ultimately why I left active duty, because I could no longer reconcile those two and didn't feel like I should continue as an infantry officer in the Marine Corps if I was having serious internal struggles and conflict with that. But yeah, so I guess I would counsel my younger self, knowing where I am now and knowing kind of what I value and where I would like to invest my time and energy. So yeah, thanks for the question.
Well, I guess you answered a slightly different one than I was aiming for you to answer. Mine was more, I think about, but the amount of time, perhaps, and the amount of effort that you pour into something. But you answered a far more interesting one, which is about the evolution, I think, of the values that we hold as individuals. And I guess if you could reflect, it doesn't have to be long, but first on perhaps what you're passionate about now. And perhaps why, and you touched on it a little bit, the conflict you had as an O3 or an infantryman and your faith, why that's different than perhaps 30-year-old Tim, 25-year-old Tim, 22-year-old Tim. Like, what on those journeys have you learned? Especially given that I think a lot of folks, and I know a great deal of high-achieving, smart, hardworking folks, of which you are one, who often feel like the grass is greener, but perhaps haven't actually lived multiple lives in multiple spots like you have. If you could perhaps reflect on what is different now, what have been those value changes in those different instantiations, and perhaps why?
Yeah, I would say there's the family piece, and you and Penny have probably experienced this too, Doug, in the sense that kids profoundly change the way that you think about the world, the way that you experience the world. And I could be in some of these modes where if you are going really hard professionally, you just miss so much of that. I'm in a mode where I'm appreciating it deeply because I'm spending lots and lots of time, in particular with my one-year-old, Declan, who's awesome. But he is a busy guy and the world is coming alive.
They have a giant task list, don't they? When they're that young, they got to check it all off. Things have to be stacked. You got to put things in the garbage bin. Yeah, it's an interesting.
But it's interesting because you spend all this time chasing worldly recognition or affirmation that, yeah, you're smart enough or you're strong enough or you're a great leader, or, you know, you can do all these things. And then there's something beautiful about that experience of parenthood that puts it all in perspective and allows you to say, actually, investing in this next generation is one of the most meaningful things that I can do on this planet in this short span of 80 years, 90 years, if we're blessed with it. And so that's really kind of on that sort of personal evolution path that I've sort of come on. And this is a season too, right? As the kids are older and they're all in school, I think it's going to open up other avenues professionally and that kind of thing they're going to be great. But I'm grateful for, in spite of having, you know, it's twofold, right? There's external expectations on you from mentors or college classmates or people that, you know, you served with either the Marine Corps or other phases of life. And they have expectations for what you should be and do. And then you also have your own internal expectations for who you should be or do and those identity type of questions, right? And so this has been a great phase for me to wrestle with both of those. And actually, the harder ones are the internal ones, because a lot of times I've found that the internal ones are reacting to or products of the culture and environment in which you're in. And one of the beautiful things about kind of hitting reset and moving from New York City to Detroit is that it's given me both the space and time to do some work around that and better understand what the priorities and values are, both in the near term and what they will be, sort of what I'm kind of considering is, you know, sort of second half of my professional marathon. I feel like I've sort of checked in at 13.1. And I'm taking a little bit different path, for the next few years. And then I've got another 13.1 ahead of me, and I'm in the process of discovering what that might look like.
Interesting. Well, I guess maybe you already alluded to it, looking at your life in terms of seasons or a bit like a sports game or a marathon, with the allusion to 13.1 versus 26.2. I guess, could you perhaps let us in on where you think that next chapter is going to lead you, and why? Why is that important? What are you trying to solve in the next? I don't want to say game time, right? Like, so this is, as you said, a reasonable game time to invest in your family, to back up, take stock, spend more time with them. Here, that is there's a reason that I hadn't been able to track you down for a year and a half. Now I can finally get you to spare an hour and a half, right? Like, what do you think that next high velocity component is going to be, and why?
I mean, I'm in the midst of working to discern what that's going to be. So a big piece of this is I started a 3-year Master's of Divinity degree at seminary, which is kind of the equivalent of an MBA or a JD for people who want to do full-time ministry. And so part of the exploration of seminary is, God, what do you have for me next in terms of what vocationally, what I'm going to be doing in terms of work? If I had to kind of present a potential future, and who knows where exactly things are going to go, what I would like to be able to do is to have an affiliation with a local church where I can pastor and preach and serve, but not necessarily be kind of like the lead or head pastor of it, be in kind of a support role that also allows me to do some integration work on faith and public policy and some potential reconciliation work within faith communities, in particular Christian faith communities between Protestants, Catholics, and Orthodox. So I don't know exactly how that's going to evolve over the coming few years, but that's kind of when I think about the future, I think it's going to be in part actively working and serving in a church and doing pastoral work. And the other part, I think, will integrate some of my policy background that intersects with faith issues. So that's kind of what I'm thinking about and dreaming about. And we'll see kind of how things develop over the next couple of years. But that's kind of where I'm at right now.
Why not go back and become, say, a chaplain and counsel those who are in a spot that you can most readily identify with? Why worry about, say, reconciling other faith communities together? I mean, we're not in the 30 years war era anymore, right? Where Catholics and Protestants are killing each other and dropping the population of European cities by 60-70% in some crazy instances because of this. Like, why is this pastoral care or counseling or psychology work, that general broad field of working with those individuals, why is counseling folks in the Midwest and reconciling these people a problem that is important to you now, especially given the background that you've had?
It's a really good question. I love military chaplains. I had some great chaplains serve with my Marine units, and I'm grateful for the Naval Academy classmates of mine who I know are working in the chaplaincy. So, like, I'm for them. I think that they do really important work. Where I'm at this point is I am grateful for an opportunity to not necessarily be thinking on kind of the national and global level, but to be more focused on the local level here in Detroit and thinking about how we go about revitalizing neighborhoods, or even not even a neighborhood, a single city block. And that happens through relationships, through neighbors building trust and watching out for one another. It comes through sustainable economic and business activities and endeavors. And I think that local churches have a really profound role to play in that space and in that field, kind of on the sort of very local level. And that gets me really excited to think about the way that churches, I guess to use the Robert Putnam term, are a core to social capital. And if social capital is important for the flourishing of a community, for the flourishing of a neighborhood, the flourishing of a city, churches have a really important role to play in that. And they can, in a very capitalist society that's all about efficiency, we're just, you know, still feeling the reverberations of GM's announced cuts here in the greater Detroit area. And, you know, I understand why Mary Barra made the decision she did. I get it from an economic perspective, but like there's something beautiful about churches working in places that isn't based on, you know, doing the demographic surveys of whether they're going to be able to be sustainable or not. And not to say that churches shouldn't be using metrics and that type of thing, but there's a whole nother level of sort of commitment and engagement that a healthy, flourishing local church takes on and is willing to take risks in areas where the government either can't or shouldn't be taking those risks, and places where businesses based on their decision making won't take those risks. And so I think there's a real space for churches in that. And I think that I'm excited about those type of opportunities to serve.
Okay. So if we take this from a straight utilitarian perspective, right? Like greatest good for the greatest number. And I try and force you to think about this in terms of number of lives impacted and depth on those lives. I can make a pretty strong argument that as a Naval Academy professor, as a DoD policy wonk, as a infantry officer, as a philanthropy guy, you had a pretty wide impact that was relatively deep on the lives of future U.S. Army officers, in the case of the work that you did at West Point and the lives of your Marines. If we think of this as kind of T-shaped, right? Like there's a wide cross-section of society that we interface with at a small level, or a very deep section that we can interface with at a deep level. And it seems like most of the people who are interfacing deeply with a few individuals are wanting to go broad. And those occasionally, like yourself, who've had that broad thing, are now oddly heading deep. And I guess I'd like to ask you two questions. One, do you feel like, and maybe this isn't the right rubric, if we just multiply number of people impacted times the amount of impact that you had, right? Why is this one in that utilitarian calculation better than what you did before? And well, maybe I'll just leave it at that one. Is that the right calculation? Or is, yeah, I'll just leave it there.
I think it's one calculation, right? I think that's one measure where, and this gets back to kind of that interplay of external hopes or aspirations that, that people place on you, and then your own internal calculus, your own internal measurements for how you think about the way you're living and the life decisions you choose. So I think by that rubric of utilitarian greatest good for the greatest number, the decisions I've made do not line up with the utilitarian perspective. I guess the only way they do is that if we have about 8 more kids, and then you draw the...
You should become a Catholic. That's really what your intent is in merging your faith communities, isn't it?
Who knows? You know, you never know. I do love my Catholic friends and love a good mass. But, you know, I guess I'm joking about that to some extent. But I think in terms of lasting impact and sort of core identity and values, I feel like this is a phase of life where, yeah, I'm not going to be able to feel like validated about myself because of the massive external impact that I'm able to achieve. But I also have sort of sensed that there can be, and not to get too philosophical on this, but there can be some meaninglessness around trying to quantify impact, especially if it ends up hollowing out your own soul in the process, or you've got to do trade-offs in your life, either fully known and accepted or unconsciously trade-offs. And I've done those too. I've certainly done unconscious trade-offs where I look back at it and it's like, oh, why? Why did I prioritize getting to that dinner or traveling, making this trip or something like that? And not to say that, you know, all doing things outside of family and that kind of thing is always problematic or something like that. But yeah, I think for me, the calculus at this point is, and especially in a new environment like we just moved into, can I listen? Can I be patient? Can I focus on the things that are most important and trust that over time that there'll be opportunities to have maybe greater influence in terms of numbers or scalability. But this isn't right now a phase of life where, you know, the scale is, it's down and in, not up and out, if you will.
Can I just pull on one piece of the language that you used a bit before? I mean, you effectively describe this season as something like a halftime or something like a mid-quarter or mid-marathon water break. Are you still deep down inside struggling with trying to make those types of utilitarian trade-offs, and you have just chosen to put those on hold for a bit? Or or have you really found a different rubric by which you score yourself when you can't sleep at night?
Have you been talking to my wife?
I haven't.
A little concerned here that there's back channel conversation between you and Jada. Yeah, I mean, I guess the way, yeah, interesting, like sort of halftime. What's the analogy? So I love this book, Let Your Life Speak, by Parker Palmer. I don't know if you've ever come across it. It's a great little book. You can read it.
But I'll put it in the show notes.
Yeah, you can read it about 2 hours. He's basically reflecting on vocation and discernment. It's largely autobiographical of him working through kind of what we've been talking about here, the external pressures, his own internal finding his true self. And it can become a little bit cliche, but he has basically, he describes that life has cycles like seasons. And this really resonated with me when I was reading it a couple months ago. He describes sort of the season of fall where leaves are letting go, plants and flowers are dying and succumbing to cold and frost, and the world is turning kind of grayer and darker. That vibrancy of summer is sort of has left, and it, you know, turns towards kind of winter. And his point about fall is that don't be deceived by kind of the color change or the external look of what's on the surface. What's happening is our seeds are being planted, and they may be dormant for a season, but there's a whole lot of activity happening under the surface within the soil. So when springtime and the brighter sunshine comes, those seeds bear fruit. And that's probably the best analogy, kind of where I'm at in this sort of cycle of my professional life. I've had sort of lots of summer, but I think endless summer is not necessarily good for the soul. And sort of going through this fall and sort of winter experience, at least on the professional side, I feel like on the personal side with the family, it's been very fruitful. But when I think about sort of my career trajectory here, I'm trusting that seeds are being planted, and I don't even know what's going to grow out of those seeds exactly, but I'm trusting that in due course, that's going to become clear. I mean, the other piece that's going on personally for us is that I was thinking about this also. It's not exactly a fall thing, but I was doing some landscaping in our yard here in Detroit, which is fun to have when you live in a 900 square foot apartment.
I don't even know what that is.
8 years. Yeah, like having a yard is pretty amazing. And I was transplanting these hostas, these flowers that were in a flower bed in the backyard that I wanted to make grass so we can have more robust soccer and games in the backyard. And I was moving them to the front yard. And I had this sort of thought that essentially this is what has happened to our family. We have been transplanted. All those root systems that we had put down for nearly a decade in New York City in terms of our friendships, in terms of our church, in terms of the work that we were doing and vocationally. And we essentially took a shovel around that root system, cut off all the roots, hopefully left enough, soil and dirt around there, and have been placed, into the front yard of Detroit to take the time to regrow those root systems. And so I'm trying to be patient as I think about the project we're on, this one of transition. Transitions are hugely important, I think, to get right. And they're great opportunities, but it takes some thought and some intentionality, I think, to do them well. So we're still in the midst of it. We're kind of giving ourselves a year. And maybe we'll need more than that, because when you have three kids, it's a little harder to do the external work of a transition like that we're in. But it has been really good. So, yeah, I don't know if that exactly answers the question or not.
I'll take it. Look, it's an honest one, and that's what I look for most answers. Well, so let me ask, like, why is in your current rubric and the one that you're developing, and admittedly, you're quite candid in saying that you're still developing it. Why is stitching together local government gaps and faith communities, why is that something that you feel like is worth all that transplanting and all that pain for? You know, I mean, to cut roots, that's non-trivially painful. You certainly do get family benefits out of it, but like, this is painful. Why?
I mean, I think part of it is a sense of trust as this opportunity started to develop. We felt like we should step out in faith and see what was going to be revealed in this experience. So it's very much one of kind of journey. And obviously it's nothing like settling the frontier or anything like that, but it is, if you want to talk about urban contrasts, to go from living in Manhattan for 8 years and not to say that there's not plenty of economic challenges within Manhattan, but the contrast to Detroit is one that's quite stark. And this is a city that was really successful for the first two thirds of the 20th century, and for the last third of the 20th century, and even to now, has had some really difficult challenges in terms of you name it, economic challenges. Race challenges and socioeconomic issues that largely border on the suburbs versus the city. And this is where kind of I look forward to being a part of some of the solutions. I mean, Jada and I had this decision, do we live in Detroit or do we live in the suburbs? And it became very clear to us that if we wanted to be part of the solution or progress in Detroit, we need to live in Detroit. We can't live in the suburbs, because doing what's easy or comfortable isn't necessarily what we feel like we should be doing in this phase. And I guess the other piece I would say on a personal level, why kind of down and in and why to uproot comes down to kind of a faith perspective, right? So like, and I think about sort of these three ways, you know, to love God, right? So that'd be first, and then to love our neighbors. And that's a part of it. And then the other thing that Jesus teaches is that we're supposed to love our enemies. We're supposed to love those that we're separated from for whatever reason, and work towards reconciliation and work towards loving them in radical and profound ways. That's kind of the way I think about the way that we want to live our lives here. Like, we want to be known as a family and as individuals who love radically, who love our God. And that translates into the way that we love our neighbors and we love those who maybe would seek to harm us or, you know, seek ill purposes in our lives and seek towards reconciliation. So that's the project. And it's worked out on, you know, a daily basis and a weekly basis as we get more and more grounded and more rooted here in Detroit.
If I could pull us back, 118 years or thereabout to the, what we affectionately referred to as the Gilded Age in America, and look at, you know, the properties that were made in Rhode Island on the beach there for folks to get out of the hustle and bustle of the stinky city at that time, as it was mostly horse-drawn. There was at that time, I don't think coincidentally, what we would now refer to as political machines, right? There was Boss Tweed, the Tammany Hall gang, little bits of esoteric bits of American history, but effectively, you know, Chicago was a fiefdom. So was New York. And it was run off of ostensibly love for your people. It was a political favors type system. Like, we're going to look after Chicago. And that's right. And I'm going to look after these Chicago, you know, I know Bill and he's been the janitor for this place, but he's got a good city job and he's going to have it for 30 years. And after those political machines were dismantled, they were in part looked at, and we very much moved, especially post-World War II, towards a more centralized government, much less federal, let alone state and local politics based. But that, if I could perhaps characterize what, say, Boss Tweed had to say at the time, it may not be that much different than what you're saying. You know, like, look, I can't control what's going on at the Breakers. I can't control what's going on in the Gilded Age, but I can control what's happening with Bill, who needs a job, and I've got him a good salary job for the city government. And all I ask in return is that, you know, he gives me votes so that I can help out other bills, and I'm going to start locally, and I can't control big issues of malfeasance, but I can try and create this community here. How do you prevent yourself from becoming, and perhaps it isn't a bad thing, maybe we should revisit our own history. How do you prevent yourself from becoming Boss Tweed or the Tammany Hall gang or another version of just looks like currying favors locally to your small group?
Yeah. I think it comes down to what your objectives are, right? Like, if your objectives are driven by power and influence and control, then you're going to use people as means to that end. But if your objective is to see the kingdom of God realized here on earth, then people cannot be means to that end, but they're in the Kantian term, they're ends themselves, right? They are the ones who are to receive and experience that love and grace of God that has a transformative effect on the way that they view themselves and the way that they interact and live in community. And so I guess that's where the faith angle kind of comes into the political piece of that. And it's also kind of personally for me where, and I'm certainly interested in what Detroit city government's doing and initiatives that are happening there. But I just I'm really intrigued and excited about the way that the church can work in spaces and places where it is difficult for even local governments to be effective, whether it be a police force or a school, you know, so yeah, that's kind of how I think about that.
Okay. Well, let me turn the time back even further, right? So we're in 8200 or thereabouts, and the Goths have just sacked Rome. What was a Pax Romana, a Roman peace enforced by men willing to do battle on behalf of those who were unable or unwilling to, that held them out, was no longer there, and Europe descended into the Dark Ages. And what brought us out of those Dark Ages in Europe was not a unitary government to start off with, and even to date, and it wasn't even local governments. At that time, the fiefdoms that were run by local chiefs who eventually, you know, became little kings and petty monarchs were as likely to slit your throat as they were to help you out, and as likely to levy an arbitrary tax on 100% of your field as they were to let you go for the better part of a few decades without any type of tax. And in that, what was called medieval heteronomy kind of control, stepped the church, which became the largest landholder in Europe. And after an ostensibly loving and caring guy named Martin Luther stapled or nailed his theses, perhaps apocryphally, to the cathedral door at Wurttemberg, some of those cities, as I mentioned already, descended into internecine conflict, which after literally Protestants pitching Catholics out the window at Prague and the Catholics saying the angels help them descend and not die, although we all know that they probably fell into kind of a large dung heap outside of the castle of Prague and prevented from dying there. They sparked a war that to this day probably has not, as a percentage of the population, seen the same kind of death as we saw in Europe at that time. And that was all around people in faith communities saying, hey, I really care and love these individuals. And Martin Luther saying, look, I really believe that the church has got something wrong here, and you shouldn't be able to buy your way to salvation. And we should start up small communities that really care and reject local centralized theocracy, a local centralized theocracy that did, for all of its other faults, preserve knowledge in monasteries and kind of bring medieval Europe out of the Dark Ages. Like, how is it that you believe that this time is different?
That was great, Doug. I enjoyed that. Human nature is a really complicated, thorny thing when we think about it, right? Like, even there, with your narrative that you were laying out, it just shows how attractive power and influence and control are, even if you're wearing the vest, you know, this these spiritual garments, right, of the church and of faith, and certainly the church through the ages has plenty of things that are reprehensible, and there's lots of physical, actual blood on their hands and metaphorical blood on their hands. I think that's absolutely true, but I think we can learn from it, and I think that we're at an interesting sort of time within our culture here in America, where we have deep divisions in our country. A lot of them are politically, but they also play out in faith circles between, at least in the Christian communities, between more conservative Christians, evangelical is the kind of complicated term of art, I guess, in some ways, and sort of more liberal or progressive social justice-based Christians. And I think we have an opportunity here in 2018, and as we're about to turn into 2019, to not repeat the way that things have happened in the past, and see if there's an opportunities for greater unity and reconciliation across. I'm speaking mostly about faith lines, but I think that if you can get the faith pieces right, that some of the political and social things can follow. So we'll see. It depends on how you look at sort of America today. I think there are plenty of ways where you could interpret things happening and be very pessimistic about the prospects for this country and the prospects for unity within this country. But I, for one, and an optimist. And I actually, I don't sort of pull on your thread there, see us at the end of Pax Americana. I think that, this country has a lot more to offer, both its citizens and the world. And I think that we're going to be in the process of bringing that about. It's not going to happen overnight. It's not going to happen in a year or two. It's going to take some time. But I think in our lifetimes, Doug, we're going to see some really promising developments. And I think that the church has an important role to play in that. And I think that individuals across political aisles and across theological spectrums have important work to do to help our country, help our communities really flourish.
Okay, I'll stop. Badgering the witness. So, look, I guess, and maybe I'll ask what I hope is a deceptively simple question. What do you think stops us from collectively reaching out and showing those who are similar to us, but not exactly the same as us, more love? I guess if I were to reflect back, and I spoke about it just a couple of weeks ago, I grew up a Royal Ranger in the Assemblies of God, one of the most evangelical Christian wings. And there was a young man, I think 23 or thereabouts, who was killed in the North Andaman Islands. He was also a Royal Ranger. And plenty of folks posted about him and said, oh, you know, he was just trying to share his faith. And it was funny because I looked at it and thought, well, look, it looks like to me like he was trying to cross the border for a country where people were known to be hostile to him. And it turns out that he got killed by people who were known for being hostile to those who are from the outside. And those same folks were at the same time saying, well, let's build a higher wall. Let's hold out the largely Catholic Hispanics who are trying to come into America today and not showing a great amount of the love and charity and kindness that is ostensibly asked for from Christians. So I guess when I reflect personally and in my near abroad, I see a lot of selective grouping, right? That people don't genuinely have a problem with showing love and care for those who they define as their in-group. But the real struggle is stretching that in-group and making themselves and forcing themselves to see it more broadly. So might I try and bring it back to, rather than a statement, to a simple question. Why do you think that people struggle to show this kind of love and care and concern? And what do you think you can do to actually help them as a pastor?
Sure. I think a part of it is the way that human nature is. We're naturally tribal, and we naturally will operate out of places of fear and pride. And that when people operate out of those places of either fear or pride, they do damage to other human beings. Sometimes it's physical damage. Sometimes it's worked out in subtler ways. But I think it's, you know, the fundamental role of the church to challenge and confront individuals, to recognize those tendencies towards fear and for pride. And through, from the Christian perspective, the power of God's grace in sending Jesus Christ, we're able to find greater trust and hope and love and humility that allows us to cross aisles or chasms between individuals, between groups, and becomes much less of the in-group, out-group dynamic and a much more holistic sense of being part of a shared community as all being children of God and having deep value for the sanctity of life throughout the entire spectrum of life, through an entire lifespan, and that we as individuals and as communities should be working towards those principles, not necessarily not the principles of fear and pride. The challenge is outworking that within kind of the local community context. And I think the church is on the front lines of that. And it has plenty of challenges in front of it to be relevant in the 21st century on those issues. But where church is happening well, those are points of light. Those are those seeds that we were talking about before, sort of that are going to shoot out through the ground and flourish and bloom in really cool ways.
All right. Let me ask perhaps a provocative one for somebody in seminary. It's not seminary. I've read it in C.S. Lewis, what, better part of 15 years ago or thereabouts, that the worst thing that God could have ever done for individuals was to make them generally good people, because they didn't feel like they genuinely really needed God for much of anything. And C.S. Lewis was clearly saying, look, I think that the only way to do this is to become a Christian, to then show the kind of love that you're talking about after a change in faith. Would you go as far as C.S. Lewis and think, oh, well, you really have to become a Christian to do this? Or in your own extension of viewing all folks as children of God, would you go so far as to stretch that to the Baha'i, the Buddhists? Are they equally a component of the solution? Or do you think they have to have a conversion experience to be able to make that kind of loving and changing difference that you're trying to make in local communities?
I think my short answer would be that other faiths can be really effective in helping individuals understand that there's more to the world than themselves, and they need to act in a way that's loving and caring to those around them. So no, I think that there's an interfaith component of this, where Christians and Muslims and Jews and Buddhists and Hindus and Baha'is and, you know, sort of fill out the list, have some things in common, and seeing that it's not just about transactional living or efficiency or, you know, kind of fill in the blank with that, but there is deeper meaning to life, and there's something about transcendence, and there's something about the whole of humanity having value that goes down to each individual. So yeah, I think there's definitely an interfaith component to that. For me personally, I find the sort of the Christian message and Jesus's message to be most profoundly compelling for me personally. And we can debate whether that's a product of my own upbringing, which is certainly a component of it, but it's something I've wrestled with over the years and continue to wrestle with. But I do find a great deal of sort of peace and joy through the Christian message of love and reconciliation and forgiveness that is what sort of propels me forward. Yeah.
I'll accept that as a sidestep on the question that others like, you know, Billy Graham perhaps might have taken up and said, hey, absolutely, there has to be a conversion experience to be able to make this.
Well, I think, you know, salvation is another question, but the good news there is that that's God's job, not ours. And when we try to take God's job and do them for God, things don't work out well. So I'm trusting that God has that well under control.
Fair enough. So I believe that's upward management is what you just did, Tim. Is that just kick that one way upstairs? Yep. All right. Very well. Hey, look, we're drawing a bit in on time here. So I guess I would love, and I know that you have just started embarking on this, and I just had Nick on the previous podcast here who spent some time doing the work as a minister that you're intending to step out into. So he has lovely, wonderfully practiced sentences about how others can do this and what it means to join one of these groups of people who show unconditional love and care for one another. I guess I would just ask you, perhaps, in what you know now, is there any admonishment that you would give to anybody who is sitting wherever they are, and folks are scattered all over the world here, about how they might be able to get involved and what they could do to practically help bring that vision of the world forward, where I think disparate communities are knit a bit more tightly together?
That's a great question. I think the starting point is making a commitment not to live out of selfish ambition or personal gain, and saying that you really desire to live in such a way that honors your fellow human being and that will work towards the thriving of your community. And I think that a church is a great opportunity to put that into practice and to have your own perspective transformed from being one that looks to your own needs and your own fulfillment to the needs and fulfillment of others. And I think the churches are on the forefront of that. Good ones are, at least. And you can probably tell fairly quickly after spending a little bit of time in a church, whether it's a good one or not. Yeah, I think that's how I'd answer it.
I think I've brought this up before, perhaps a year or two ago. There's this thing called the no true Scots problem. Are you familiar with that as a logical fellow?
Yeah.
So, well, for the benefit of the listeners, I think in brief, the story goes something like old Scottish man sitting and says, you know, no Scot would commit murder, right? And then son comes next day and brings him a paper that says Scotsman kills somebody else, right, in cold blood. And the old Scottish man leans back and says, no true Scot would commit murder, right? How, in your experience, do you avoid the no true Scots problem? Is there a North Star? I mean, you intimated that you could somehow feel this. And for those of us who like more tangible metrics or more easy things to grasp onto, how do you discern whether or not you're in a Boss Tweed, Tammany Hall type self-serving organization versus one that genuinely has this kind of broader, hey, I want to incorporate everybody in the community into it?
Yeah, I think I'll invoke Jesus on this, since we're on this faith angle right now, that it's by the fruit that you'll recognize, and this is sort of Jesus, paraphrasing Jesus on this, it's by their fruit that you'll recognize his followers, or you can extrapolate that out beyond Christian terms as well and say it's by the fruit of the organization or the company or the governmental entity that you're working in, how you determine whether it's a good organization and it's something you want to be a part of. And so I think that in this case, actions and the physical results that you see out of an organization or an institution or out of a church are how we should think about it and measure it, and look to its fruit, right? Is it fulfilling its mission and purpose? Is that mission and purpose something that aligns with your own values? So I think that, I don't know if that solves the no true Scot thing, but I think it's by the fruit is how you're going to recognize either an organization or a church.
Fair enough. Okay. Just to rapidly try and wind things down, as I try and do keep things at about an hour or thereabouts of recording, I'd love to just close off with a couple of quick rapid fire questions for you and then close it off. So I guess this might be unfair given the amount of time that you're spending in seminary now, but I challenge you to think broadly. What are the things that you are learning right now? And really the root of that question is, if somebody has caught a glimpse of the type of vision that you're trying to pull on and is interested in heading down that path, have you run into anything that you would commend to anybody else about that?
So where to start, I guess, to unpack this last semester. Two thoughts for you real quick, and then I've got to run here too, just because the natives are restless. One is, I think that there's sort of a whole person approach to spirituality that I think is really foundational to living a healthy, thriving life. And so one of the things I've been learning about and thinking about is, you know, how do you incorporate the right rhythms into your life so that you can be not only spiritually healthy, but also physically and emotionally and intellectually healthy. And so ideas of Sabbath rest, of in our hyper-connected world, shutting off devices and spending intentional time in silence, and opportunities to journal and reflect. And think back to sort of Ignatius of Loyola has this examine process by which you take a chunk of time, a day, a week, a season of life, and examine that in front of God. So that's one area, this sort of what I'd call sort of healthy spirituality and practices and rhythms in life that I've been thinking about. And then the other one is probably more theologically based and in trying to understand the complexity and the mystery of the Holy Trinity, God the Father, God the Son, and God the Holy Spirit, is the other area that I've been thinking and writing a fair amount about recently. It's been really rewarding to think through some of that and to reflect on the vastness of creation and what it means to be placed here on this, you know, little speck of a planet in galaxy that has billions of stars and in a universe that has billions of galaxies, and think about a God that's in charge of all that and loves us more than we can ever understand or even imagine. So that's been great to kind of spend some time reflecting on those things as well.
Awesome. I will try and connect up a little bit later on book recommendations or anything like that, and we'll put those in there in the show notes if you want.
That's great.
Look, want to be sensitive to your time, and I would just love to ask you one more if you got it, and it can be as long or as short as you like it. Simply, is there anything I should have asked you that I didn't? And if you just want to roll straight into answering it.
I think we covered it, Doug. I think that this has been really fun for me to be on the witness stand as you unpack my brain at this season of life. So thank you for it. I appreciate it.
Absolutely. Thanks for taking the time. And I hope that I can catch you in the midst of one of your other future seasons to give an alternate reflection on it. But thanks again for your time.
That sounds great. I look forward to it.
I want to thank Vasilis Skouri for doing all the digital remastery on this track. He's a self-trained audio engineer working out of Europe. He has a collection of extraordinary tracks, both music, wordless, as well as he's done a lot of great producing work for other people. I appreciate him taking his time to clean this up and make it sound like more than just a simple recording between two people. Thanks again, Vasilis.